Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Welcome to the Curiously Specific Book Club, the podcast that's curiously specific about dates and locations in well-known books, presented by Lloyd Shepherd and Tim Wright.
This is the second part of our journey into the world of H.G. Wells' War of the Worlds. In part one, we spent a lot of time in Woking, but now we're going to head down the Thames, following the tripod's trail of destruction, starting in Shepperton, and then we're going to go across Richmond Bridge to Sheen, and then on into central London.
Wherever Sheen is.
Oh, spoiler.
Spoiler.
And ending in central London in Primrose Hill.
Like all 90s rock stars, we're going to end in Primrose Hill. If you're listening to this as a Patreon subscriber, you've got this episode coming into your ears immediately on the back of our first episode. If you'd like to get immediate access to second episodes and new episodes, as well as access to all our really good stuff around maps and show notes and links to references and pictures and videos, head over to patreon.com, search for Curiously Specific, and check out all our different subscription tiers there.
Yes, I think you get a lot of value out of our research material for planning your own adventure.
Yeah.
If you're an H.G. Wells fan, you're going to really enjoy that.
So where are we off to first?
We're going to go to Shepperton.
Oh, it's J.G. Ballard country.
Is it?
Apparently.
Wrong book.
Oh, no, sorry.
Death, I shouted. Death is coming. Death! That was in Byfleet.
That was in Byfleet, yeah. He's come on from Byfleet.
And then we're into Weybridge.
We're sitting opposite the Shepperton lock, where the Wey, River Wey, meets the River Thames, and the Wey navigation reaches the River Thames as well, so it's a three-way entrance into the Thames.
Just boats puttering around.
It's rather lovely,
isn't it?
A couple
of Canada geese.
It's a very Kenneth Graham vista.
Well, I was saying Thelwell.
Thelwell, yeah.
Rather than Kenneth Graham.
Rather cruelly.
In the book,
yeah,
we remained at Weybridge until midday, and then at that hour, we found ourselves at the place near Shepperton Lock, where the Wey and the Thames join.
Yep.
So what we're looking at the moment is the River Thames.
It is.
The Wey just down
just
to our left.
Just past where the junction is, yeah.
We're on the south bank of the Thames, as it were.
And we're looking at a grand, white, old white building with lawns looking down to the water's edge.
The Wey has a treble mouth, and at this point, boats are to be hired, and there was a ferry across the river.
Yep.
There still is a ferry across the river.
There is.
It's a very small little sort of flat boat that you basically call on demand. Someone sits there and then you wave and they come puttering across.
Yep.
It says here that on the Shepperton side was an inn with a lawn.
Which is the other side to what we're where we are.
We see a building with a lawn that looks quite
like, could have been an inn,
but is now a private home.
Yeah.
But it does look quite,
well, it looks like it could be a hotel. I mean, it's quite large. Yeah.
And beyond that, the tower of Shepperton Church,
yeah,
it has been replaced by a spire, rose above the trees.
Yeah.
Well, now, we have a problem with that.
Well, we can't see it. And there are trees here.
It wouldn't be tall enough.
There's no way it would be. I mean,
there's a very large Lylande in the Wey at the moment, but even so.
But even so, it would have to be hugely, I mean, it would have to be Notre Dame tall to be visible from here. So I don't quite know what he's on about there.
It's a bit odd, isn't it?
Yeah. Suddenly we saw a puff of smoke that jerked up into the air and hung, and forthwith the ground heaved underfoot, and a heavy explosion shook the air, smashing two or three windows in the houses near. "Here they are!" shouted a man in a blue jersey. "Yonder! Do you see them? Yonder!" Quickly, one after the other, one, two, three, four of the armoured Martians appeared, far away over the little trees, across the flat meadows that stretched towards Chertsey, and striding hurriedly towards the river. Little cowled figures they seemed at first, going with a rolling motion and as fast as flying birds. Then, advancing obliquely towards us, came a fifth. Their armoured bodies glittered in the sun as they swept swiftly forward upon the guns, growing rapidly larger as they drew nearer. One on the extreme left, the remotest, that is, flourished a huge case high in the air, and the ghostly, terrible heat ray I had already seen on Friday night smote towards Chertsey and struck the town.
Okay.
They come up to the river, don't they?
So then his idea about this was to get underwater to save himself the heat ray.
Yes.
And then, of course, one of them gets hit by a shell, by an army shell at this point.
Yes.
And crashes into Shepperton Church and smashes it up.
Well, first of all, it crashes into the river, doesn't it? And then it crashes.
It sort of loses control of itself and staggers off.
And smashes into Shepperton Church, which is why he says it's now a steeple. Because to emphasise...
They rebuilt it.
This book is written after the events, looking back on the events that happened at some point.
Yeah.
In a date we will talk about.
Yeah.
He does talk about the small trees, doesn't he? So maybe it's just that the trees are much taller now than they were in...
You would see the Martian.
Going over that way.
Yeah.
And then he says after it smashes the church, it goes out of sight, the other side of the church, which you would expect.
Yeah. So that sort of figures, don't you think?
Yep. It all works. It all works apart from not being able to see the church.
Yeah, but everything else is fine. Apart from... Why does he not mention Doily Cart Island?
Doily Cart Island is an island in the Thames, just to our right. I'm looking at it right now. It's got a massive, great, slightly creepy-looking house on it. I mean, must be...
The Guardian describes it as a crumbling mansion.
It is huge. Three floors.
Actually, it was only recently in an article on the 5th of August... 2021, so not that long ago.
Yeah.
Doily Cart Island, complete with crumbling mansion, sold for £3 million. Mystery local buyer hopes to restore Thames site. Now, Doily Cart Island.
Yeah.
Listeners might know Doily Cart.
Gilbert and Sullivan fans will know.
Yes, exactly, because Doily Cart was the man who promoted and produced Gilbert and Sullivan musicals and made a lot of money doing so. This house we're looking at was... He bought the island, which is known as Folly Eyot.
Yeah, and Eyot is an island in the Thames.
Thames Islands, Eyot, E-Y-O-T.
Yeah.
And he bought it in 1890.
So he bought the island in 1890.
Yes, and he developed it. He was building the house...
In 1896.
Around the time we're talking about, right?
So Wells would have seen that being built.
Absolutely.
Doesn't strike me as a sort of opera musicals fan... H.G. Wells.
Do you think he didn't like a bit of Gilbert and Sullivan?
I thought it was a bit frivolous.
Well, they were sort of on the wane by then, anyway,
They've been going a long while. But, I mean, they were 1850s they started?
Well, I think their last work together was 1895 or something, and it was a flop. And they'd already fallen out quite badly. But he built this house initially to be an extension of the Savoy Hotel, that you could book it. And you could take a boat... From the Savoy, from the Strand, from Waterloo Bridge around there, and come down here and take a suite here.
Oh.
Right. That was his idea. It was going to be sort of Savoy's out of town luxury rooms.
It's like Soho House and Chipping Norton, kind of idea.
With its own boat, ferry service back into London, right?
Oh, yeah.
Quite fancy.
Yeah, yeah.
But the local Shepperton council wouldn't give him a drinking licence. So he couldn't run it as a hotel, he felt.
That seems very likely around here, doesn't it?
So then he made it into his private home.
Do you think they probably thought Doily Cart was a bit of a revist? Well, no, it was very middle class around here, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Definitely.
So he's quite an influential guy. He brought sort of French cookery to London. He was in charge of the Ritz, the Savoy, the Adelphi, I mean, all the big hotels.
So you've got a lot of information now on this guy that Wells doesn't mention.
Well, why wouldn't you? If you were sitting here, it's the talk of the town, isn't it?
You would think it would be.
And also, if you're so keen on smashing up everything you don't like about places between Woking and London, where people are too successful or bourgeois.
Or bourgeois. Or, it's bourgeois he's got a problem with.
Yeah, I would say Gilbert and Sullivan fans are first for the heat ray, aren't they?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. They're not what you would call socialist.
Sorry, any guilt.
Socialist. They're not socialist fair, are they?
As someday it may happen that a victim must be found, I've got a little list of society offenders who might well be underground and who never would be missed. There's the pestilential nuisances who write for autographs, all people who have flabby hands and irritating laughs, all children who are up in dates and floor you with them flat, all people who on shaking hands shake hands with you like that, and all third persons who on spoiling tete-a-tetes insist, they'd none of them be missed.
He's got them on the list, he's got them on the list, and they none of them be missed, they'll none of them be missed.
So that's Shepperton destroyed.
Yeah, well, Shepperton Church seems like it really was destroyed because we couldn't see it.
No.
So,
but I think the question we want to ask ourselves is, why is it that H.G. Wells wants to destroy London suburbia?
Specifically London suburbia.
Yeah, and why is he worried about invasion as well?
Well, again, if you've not been to these parts of London, you know, London did sprawl in the second half of the 19th century, and it generally sprawled out along the lines of the railways, and Woking is an example of that. But the type of houses that are being built are, you know, relatively small, three or four bedrooms. People who work as clerks in the city are buying them. And it's a certain type of middle-class lifestyle that is emerging, an outlook, I suppose you'd say.
Do you know about the Marchetti Constant?
No, dear. I do not know about the Marchetti Constant.
It's very interesting. Cesare Marchetti, or Marchetti, an Italian physicist.
Yeah.
I'm getting this from Bloomberg, by the way, bloomberg.com.
Okay.
An article called "The Commuting Principle That Shaped Urban History." Cesare Marchetti, in general, he declared, people have always been willing to commute for about half an hour one way from their homes each day. And this has been true throughout all history. A walking city is a certain size. And then...
So it's trains.
So trains are what's going to have a massive impact on London.
Yeah.
1870. He's got a lovely map on here of the size of Paris and the size of Rome. The size of Rome in 275 and the size of London in 1870.
Yeah.
Did you know, in fact, today, the travel time between London, Waterloo and Woking is 26 minutes.
Yeah.
There's a very good bit. Quite early on in the book, he meets an artillery man who survived the first heat ray attack.
Yeah.
They get split up at Shepperton, don't
they?
They
do, yeah.
But he meets him again on Wimbledon Common, or just by or sort of Putney-Wimbledon way. He's survived, and he's gone a bit loopy.
Yeah.
And has decided that the way to survive is going to be to sort of live underground and become a different kind of human race.
Which, when you think the time machine came out 3 or 4 years earlier, which is exactly what happened.
And the narrator realises, oh, this guy's a bit nutty, I better leave him behind.
Yeah.
But he does a long speech, the artillery man, where he says that the suburban people who have been, that he's lived with before, are going to be no good against the Martians. All these sort of people that lived in these houses and all those damn little clerks that used to live down that way, they'd be no good. They haven't any spirit in them. No proud dreams and no proud lusts.
Mm.
And a man who hasn't one or the other, Lord, what is he but funk and precautions?
Mm.
They just used to skedaddle off to work. I've seen hundreds of them. Bit of breakfast in hand, running wild and shining to catch their little season ticket train for fear they'd get dismissed if they didn't. Working at businesses they were afraid to take trouble to understand. Skedaddling back for fear they wouldn't be in time for dinner. Keeping indoors after dinner for fear of the back streets, and sleeping with the wives they married, not because they wanted them, but because they had a bit of money that would make for safety in their one little miserable skedaddle throughout the world.
I wish you could see Tim's face while he was reading that. It's like the authentic face of H.G. Wells there. It was like, the contempt in those lines is quite something.
So I think he's slightly aligned with the artillery man, do you not feel?
Well, I think so. Yeah. I think we're seeing the authorial voice emerge there.
And alongside that, of course, is the growing fear of the Germans and of invasion. So the combination of it's possible that Britain could be invaded by an alien power, but also that there's the enemy within, which is the suburban culture of just getting on a train, getting off a train, not having backbone, not having any lust.
Yeah, well, it's not the enemy within so much as, like, you know, the fine living Oakley Englishman is being degraded by this lifestyle and these choices, and it won't serve as well when the Martians come. Although, to be fair, no one really stands up to the Martians. I mean, it is extraordinary, isn't it, that this whole book, the Martians should choose the southwest suburbs of London. You could see why they went for London.
No, they went for the heart of empire. They looked at the world and said, two-thirds of this globe is being run by some people from London.
Yeah, but do you think they went for the heart of empire and just missed by 20 miles? And that's why they end up in Woking. Because it takes them a while.
Well,
it takes them a while to get their eye in.
We're going to have to talk about where they landed.
Where the cylinders land, yeah.
There were ten cylinders landed, but they're not all accounted for.
No.
I'm slightly annoyed about that.
You are slightly annoyed about that. Moving on. So we've been to Woking and we've been to Weybridge and Shepperton.
Where are we going now?
Well, so we wanted to try... There's an amazing scene in the book where he's basically trapped in the basement of a house in Sheen, which is further into London.
Yes, after he's floated down the river after the attack, he comes out on the shore and he meets a curate.
Who's a bit funny in the head.
He's gone a bit loopy.
And they make their way over Richmond Bridge and sort of across the Thames and sort of get towards London. They're heading sort of northeastwards. There's an attack by another tripod and there's another landing.
Right. Yes.
It's another landing while they're in Sheen, and it lands on the house that they're in.
Coincidentally, it lands right on the house that they're in.
He's right in amongst it, this guy. I mean, have we not considered that the Martians have just not got it in for the narrator due to some sort of terrible slight that he wasn't even aware of?
Do you know how long they're stuck in there for?
No.
But I do.
Oh, do you?
Yeah.
should we talk about that when we get to timings?
Yeah.
Yeah, but it's a long time. So we're off to Sheen.
It can't be midnight yet, I said, and then came a blinding glare of vivid green light. Everything in the kitchen leaped out, clearly visible in green and black, and vanished again. And then followed such a concussion as I have never heard before or since. So close on the heels of this as to seem instantaneous came a thud behind me, a clash of glass, a crash, and rattle of falling masonry all about us, and the plaster of the ceiling came down upon us, smashing into a multitude of fragments upon our heads. So they're in a house.
This is the fifth canister.
The fifth cylinder. Abruptly, the right interpretation dawned on my mind. The fifth cylinder, I whispered.
The fifth cylinder.
The fifth shot from Mars has struck this house and buried us under the ruins. So
where is that house?
So where is the house? So we're trying to find the house where he hides with the curate, escaping from Woking and Weybridge and walking towards London, but also with an idea that he might get to Leatherhead. He's walking in completely the wrong direction for Leatherhead, but I guess he's also trying to avoid the Martians, so he's thinking that maybe...
He's trying to avoid marriage.
Maybe he's trying to avoid his wife. So he's made it to... He makes it over the bridge to Richmond, and then he describes as walking towards Kew, and then they change direction. And then he says they go through Sheen. Now, we're in southwest London, near the Thames. We're into London now, I think it's fair to say. And Sheen lies just to the east of Richmond.
Oh, no.
Or does it?
You know what? This blew my mind.
Just to point out, there's an East Sheen station.
Yeah.
And there's a North Sheen station.
Yeah.
There's no Sheen station. There doesn't seem to be a Sheen.
Yeah. Visitors to the UK, especially from America, will find this pretty normal for Britain.
Yeah.
Is that we sort of have north something, east something, west something,
and not something.
But we don't have the something.
No, it's just gone.
And we don't know where it is.
No.
So I was thinking, well, there's North Sheen and there's East Sheen, so we can just triangulate between those two things and that'll be Sheen.
Yeah.
But it's Richmond.
Well, it is up to a point, but in the book he does talk about walking through Richmond.
No, across Richmond Bridge. Yes.
No, then he talks about Richmond burning behind him up the hill.
Okay.
So for him, Richmond.
But then he
is
says
the
Sheen was untouched or
Sheen
something
was
like
untouched.
That. So he's got a distinction between Richmond and Sheen in his head.
And I think
but historically, it was Sheen before it was Richmond.
Yeah.
Richmond was a name invented by Henry VII.
It was.
There has been, historically, a Sheen palace since Edward
III. Yes.
And it was Henry V was particularly fond of it and modernised it and did all kinds of lovely things with it. So but when the Tudors turned up, Henry VII, he said, right, that's it, we're not even going to call it Sheen Palace, we're just going to call it Richmond Palace. And then he revamped it.
But
and then, of course, his son, Henry VIII, said, I don't even want to live there, I'm going to build an even bigger palace in Hampton Court.
Yanking you back to the 19th/20th century,
yeah.
H.T. Wells describes walking through Sheen. So Sheen is a place, as far as he's concerned.
Yes.
And it's not Richmond, because Richmond is described as burning.
Okay. But it's not Kew, either.
It's not Kew.
And it's not
So the road that runs, there's a road Morley. That runs from Richmond to East Sheen.
Yes.
Which we can imagine plausibly running through some kind of non-specific zone that's a bit called Sheeny. Sheen.
Yeah.
And that's where we are now. And it's called the Upper Richmond Road. And the reason it's called the Upper Richmond Road is because it's a bit higher than the Lower Richmond Road, which means you can look back towards Kew, which he describes as doing, right?
Yeah, there's a tripod there, and he sees it over towards Kew Lodge.
So we quite like the locale. The trouble is there's a lot of large Victorian houses along this road.
Mm.
But we are standing next to one that is in a road called Kings Farm Avenue.
Kings Farm Avenue.
So on the corner of Kings Farm Avenue and Upper Richmond Road.
He describes a large white house with a walled garden.
Yeah.
These are not white.
They're not
but
white.
They're clear brick, and they could easily have been, cleaned up. They could have
point.
Been white at the time.
They could have been rendered.
There is a walled garden with quite a large tree in it.
Yeah.
And there is even a bit of a conservatory at the back, although that's modern.
So it fits the description of the house quite well. But
and of running across the road at a point when the road curves towards Mortlake, which is another thing he says.
Yeah, he does mention
so
that.
It's sort of right, but I think given the fact that we can't even find Sheen,
but
it's not surprising if we don't find the house.
But if you were walking, if you wanted to kind of find a house that matched the bill, the house
this
on the
it.
Corner of Kings Farm Avenue and Upper Richmond Road isn't bad.
But let's remind ourselves again that it would be a kind of 60-yard cylinder will have bombed into the back of that from outer space, and yet somehow it survived.
Well, can I just point out that there is a gap between 202 and 204 Upper Richmond Road, because we're standing in it right now.
That is true.
So
I like it, because when he come out of the house, when he after 15 days in this house...
It's 15 days with the
he comes out onto the lip of the crater and looks north again towards Kew. So if he was on this upper road then there was a crater that he went up, he would have a fantastic view from
back
here, looking right across Kew.
Back towards Kew.
Would be there.
It's good.
We've got two very large trees here that are quite old as well.
Plane trees, yeah.
Good enough, I think.
I think I'm
taking it.
I think it fits the bill.
I was really hoping, you know what I was really hoping?
What?
That just down the road, on a similar kind of corner, big white house with a walled garden, Mark Boland's house.
Oh, he did live near here, didn't he?
Yeah. So I like the idea that Martians had landed in Mark Boland's house.
It'd be better if it was David Bowie's house.
Yeah, I know. It's close, though.
It's not
maybe
bad.
Maybe they got confused.
It's rock adjacent.
It's rock adjacent.
It all sounds the same to the Martians.
Well, what, Boogaloo?
David Bowie.
Boogaloo. They came for the Boogaloo.
I'm going to talk about the greatest problem mankind has to face. I do not mean the greatest problem that any man may have to face. Personal problems are individual. They differ with every one of us. But I mean the greatest problem that is before our race as a whole. And that is how we are to get rid of the old governments that we have worn out and that we have grown out of.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
So we've already talked about the book was published in Pearson's in 1897, published in hardback for the first time in 1898. But we haven't talked about when is the book actually set?
Very good. I've done a lot of work on
and
this.
This is
my favourite bit.
If you're new to the Curiosity Specific Book Club, this is very much Tim's favourite bit.
I love this kind
of
thing.
If there's train timetables involved, that's where I come in.
Yeah.
If it's dating, making kind of curious connections between potential dates in the books that are often quite spurious between you and me, listener. This is very much Tim's wheelhouse. So over to you, Tim.
Well, the thing to do, listener, if you're really part of this book club, what you do is, as you go through it, you note when day breaks and night falls. Okay. And you note every day that's mentioned, whether it's a Tuesday or a Wednesday.
Yeah.
So that by the end of the book, you're very clear as to how long this book has been going on for.
Yeah.
And this book goes on for 30 days.
Exactly 30 days?
Pretty much, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. If anybody wants to contact me to know what happens on every day, from day one, which is we know is a Friday in June, by the way, because he mentions that.
We do know it's a Friday in June.
I mean, obviously, right at the beginning, you read out at the beginning.
Nobody would have believed.
Yes. What's the next thing they say?
I don't know.
In the last years of the 19th century.
Yes, that's the...
That this world was being watched.
So he's saying this in the 20th century.
And early in the 20th century came the Great Disillusionment.
Okay. Meaning the 30 days.
Yeah. Now we have to get into something a little bit tricky here.
strap in, listener.
Well... Normally we talk about train timetables. We might stray into tide tables.
Yeah, yeah.
But here we have to talk about astronomical tables, don't
we? Okay, okay.
Because we have to talk about the opposition of Mars.
It's worth pointing out at this stage that Wells failed his paper in astronomical physics at the normal school. Which is quite ironic when you think about what he wrote next.
So what's very interesting to me is that he says that during the opposition of 1894, a great light was seen. Blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
Then it says peculiar markings were seen near the site of that outbreak during the next two oppositions.
Right.
And then it says the storm burst upon us 6 years ago now as Mars approached opposition.
Okay. So shall we define our terms, Tim?
So I'll go back through that for you.
What is opposition?
Right. So basically what the opposition of Mars is, it's essentially when the Earth and Mars are as close together as they could possibly be.
Yeah.
Now, think of us all spinning around the sun.
In the same plane.
Right. Yeah, possibly. That's a bit of a tricky one.
Yeah.
But if we just said they were spinning around, so we take a year to go all the way around the sun, right? Yeah. And the Mars, because it's further away and has a bigger lorry, it takes roughly two years
to
get around the sun. Yeah. And as it's going around, if you saw them both spinning around, there are going to be moments when they're very far away from each other.
Or they're on opposite sides of the sun.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's conjunction, right?
Yeah, conjunction. Or they're very close together. And if you want to travel between Mars and Earth, you would obviously want to travel when they're as near to each other as possible. And even today, on these new Mars explorers, when NASA decide to launch an explorer to go to Mars, they launch it during the opposition of Mars to minimise the journey time.
Right.
So we, in reverse, we do the same thing that the Martians do.
The Martians are doing.
And they say that basically, at midnight, for 10 days... there are little explosions of like a giant cannon launching these pods.
Yeah.
40 millions of Mars it was between us, more than 40 millions. So that night, another invisible missile started on its way to Earth just a second or so under 24 hours after the first one. So we've got the opposition of 1894, then we've got the next two oppositions, and then he says, as the next opposition was nearing, and he mentions the midnight of the 12th.
That's when the first blast is seen.
Yeah, and we know these are very predictable. The oppositions.
Well, you'd hope.
They're every 26 months, roughly.
Okay.
But there's charts out there. If you want to look it up online, you can find them. And there's even a historical one, which is great. So we know that the one of October 1894, that Mars was roughly 43 million miles away from us. That then in December 1896,
when he's writing the book,
52 million miles away. Yeah. Then January 1899. So the one that where they see them coming is in February 1901.
Okay, I'm like that. I like this. This is good.
Yeah,
okay,
right.
So the book says 1894 for the first opposition.
Yeah.
There's two more, 1896, 1899.
Then Ogilvy goes, come and have a look at this.
And the next one is
1901. In the early years of the 20th century.
In the early years of the 20th century. Very
so,
good.
And he mentions the 12th, the night of the 12th, that Ogilvy says he saw the first explosion.
Yeah.
And there are 10 pods.
There are.
So the closest Mars comes during that time is the 22nd of February, 10 days after the 12th. Do we like that?
We do.
Yeah. So, but now you've got to decide, how long does it take a Martian to get to Earth?
Yes.
Because that's when they fired off from Mars.
Yes.
When do they land?
Yes.
Now, we know they land in June because he says it's in June.
It's June, yeah.
But is it June 1901?
Or 1902.
Or is it June 1902?
So if it was June 1901 and they're launching in February, they'd have to get there across in 4 months.
Yeah. So how quickly...
Is that conceivable?
Well, I've had a look at how fast things travel between Mars.
Of course you have.
Yeah. If you're travelling 40 million miles and you wanted to get there by June, you'd want to be travelling at 14.5 miles per hour. 1,000 miles, 14.5 miles an hour. But twice the speed of a London minicab at the time.
That would be inside the Locomotions Act of 1896.
No, 14,500 miles an hour, right? So, and yes, this is right, the shuttle's going at 17.5 miles an hour. So it's perfectly possible for them to go that fast. But actually, Mars rovers, things that go to Mars, because we've got those now, they tend to take between 7 and 9 months. And the reason is, and this is where your science bit comes in, is you don't fly direct, do you?
No.
You fly in a parabola, as it
were. Well, because the planets are moving all the time.
Yeah, exactly. You'd have to be going really quite fast on a weird direct trajectory.
Well, it is a rocket.
To get there in 1901.
But it is a rocket, though, isn't it? So do we?
Now, there's two other things in the book that bother me, right?
Okay. Apart from the fact that he abandons his wife in Leatherhead.
No, but that one thing I've already read out, which is he said he refers to that he's telling this story from 6 years ago.
Yes.
He's narrating it 6 years after it's happened.
Yes.
And then he says, really near the end of the book, he says, at present, the planet Mars is in conjunction.
Right.
But with every return to opposition, I, for one, anticipate a renewal of the Martians' adventure. Like they're going to come back.
Right? Yeah.
So he's writing this six years after it happened, at a point when there's a Mars conjunction.
Yeah.
Now, they're predictable as well.
Of course.
Right? When was the Mars conjunction? There isn't one in 1901.
There wouldn't be, because there's an opposition in 1901.
It's in March 1902.
Yeah, so it'll be every other year, roughly.
Yeah.
So 1902.
Keep going.
1904.
Yeah. 1906. 1908.
1908.
So if it's 6 years, it can't be 1907, can it? It's got to be 1908 that he's writing it.
Which suggests that the cylinder's landed in 1902.
Yes. So if you look at the calendar of 1902.
So we know it's a Friday and we know it's June.
Yeah.
So, okay, when were the Fridays in June in
1902? I wish I'd written this down now. Give me a moment. I've got so much stuff here. It's brilliant.
I'm looking at Tim's notebook and it's just pages and pages of charts.
Yeah, but I'll tell you why I liked it, is this. So finally, you go to a calendar of 1902 in June. There are four Fridays, the 6th, the 13th, the 20th and the 27th. So if it was to happen across 30 days, you'd be saying that the Martians landed on the 6th of June, 1902.
Yeah.
Now, the reason I kind of like this, I know he's making this up from the future.
I'm glad you realise that.
Yeah, but is that when was Edward VII crowned king?
Well, he was king from 1901, but was he actually crowned in 1902?
Well, here's the thing. It was originally scheduled for the 26th of June, 1902, but it was cancelled. It was postponed because he was...
I love what you're going with.
You see what I'm doing here? Yeah. This is like... No, but this is good. This is like a proper kind of Roswell conspiracy type thing.
Yeah. So you know where I'm going? There was a Martian invasion.
They cancelled... They said he was a bit unwell and had to have some surgery.
He had to have some surgery?
Yeah.
My days.
Yeah. And he had a carefully planned as a spectacle, and he had to revise it all.
and he wasn't crowned until the 9th of August 1902. But it's quite nice to think that he projected
a month after the
So he basically was predicting the end of the Victorian era and the beginning of the Edwardian era as the cut-off point of when the Martians came.
But he didn't know that in 1896.
No,
uncanny.
No, uncanny, right?
That is really, really good. I love it.
So we're saying that the Martians landed on Friday, the 6th of June, 1902.
Is this a good point to say, why do they land where they land, these cylinders? Because the thing that's always puzzled me is, right, you're firing a rocket off from Mars every 24 hours. The Martian day isn't 24 hours. It's just over 24 hours. So the position in which you're firing the rocket from on Mars...
They're doing it in Earth time.
They must be doing it on Earth time, which means they must be trying to land the rockets all in the same place.
Yes.
And just not quite getting it.
Well, just, because they would be slightly off.
There is a slightly random pattern. So they land in Horsell Common in Woking, but the later ones land in Byfleet and Wimbledon.
Do you want a list?
Go on, give me the... Well, there's an interesting thing about the list, isn't there, which I know you want to talk about. So
They fire...
10 cylinders.
Yeah.
They fire 10
Between
cylinders.
The 12th of February and the 22nd of February, there are 10 launches.
Yeah.
First one lands in Horsell Common.
Yeah.
Second one in what is referred to as Addlestone Golf Course.
Yeah.
Which we now know is called New Zealand Golf Course. Still there. The third one, they say, lands in Purford. They say the fourth one landed in Bushy Park. Now, for people who don't know London, if you looked up Bushy, you'd think, oh, that's miles off. But actually, there's a Bushy Park inside Hampton Court.
Yeah.
The fifth one is the one that lands on the house in Mortlake.
Yeah.
Or
Sheen. Yeah.
The sixth one, he says, lands in Wimbledon.
Which
on
is
the
kind
Common.
Of off course. Right?
Wimbledon Common.
They broadly speaking...
Well, they're coming towards London.
Coming towards centre of London. Then
they're following him around, because he's near there.
Trying to hit him.
Yeah.
And then the Wimbledon Common one is a little bit random, because that's further to
the seventh one lands in Primrose Hill.
Yeah.
And then 8, 9, 10, nobody cares.
Not mentioned.
Don't care where they landed.
Not mentioned at all.
Don't care where they landed. So there's three unaccounted for. But if they got news that the bacteria was killing them by day 7, they would then telepathically tell the people inside 8, 9, 10, don't come out of your cylinder.
And they're still there.
Yes.
They're still there. Okay. Like it?
I think they should be excavating the garden of Buckingham Palace is what I think they should be doing.
We're about to move off to our last location, I think, aren't we?
Oh, yes.
Yeah. So after much adventure and destruction and chaos, our hero arrives at Primrose Hill in the north of London.
I missed my way among the streets and presently saw down a long avenue in the half light of the early dawn the curve of Primrose Hill. On the summit, towering up to the fading stars, was a third Martian, erect and motionless like the others. An insane resolve possessed me. I would die and end it, and I would save myself even the trouble of killing myself. I marched on recklessly towards this Titan, and then, as I drew nearer and the light grew, I saw that a multitude of black birds was circling and clustering about the hood. At that my heart gave a bound and I began running along the road. I hurried through the red weed that choked St. Edmund's Terrace and emerged upon the grass before the rising of the sun. Great mounds had been heaped about the crest of the hill, making a huge redoubt of it. It was the final and largest place the Martians had made, and from behind these heaps there rose a thin smoke against the sky.
So they've built a fort, essentially, at the top of Primrose Hill?
Yes, they have.
Why would they do that?
Ah, well, tell the listener where we are.
Well, we are on Primrose Hill. We are at the top of Primrose Hill. For anyone who doesn't know London, Primrose Hill is a... it's a hill.
It's a hill.
It's in the north of London. It's between Camden and St John's Wood, and it looks down over. It's an amazing view. It's a really amazing view. You made the very good point when we were standing up there making some video that if you wanted to kind of lay waste to London with a heat ray, Primrose Hill is a pretty good place to place your heat ray gun.
You basically have an uninterrupted 270-degree view across the whole of London.
Including all the way down to Crystal Palace. right, which he says in the book he can see.
He claims that he can see that.
It's interesting that he mentions Kilburn and Imperial.
Yes.
Now, just before he wrote this book, in 1889, he was living on Primrose Hill. He was living in a place called Fitzroy Road, which is just the east side of Primrose Hill.
Mm-hmm.
The northeast side of Primrose Hill, that makes sense.
Yes, that's right, yeah. The chalk farm side.
He was living there with his aunt and Isabel, the cousin that he's basically been trying to get into bed with for a considerable amount of time, who's resisting it, who he eventually marries. So he's been living up here. And while he's been living here, first of all, he was studying at Imperial for his normal degree, which is the teacher training qualification. But then later he was teaching at a school in Kilburn.
Oh.
And one of the people he was teaching was A.A. Milne.
Oh, really?
Creator of Winnie the Pooh.
Now, another apocalyptic novel.
Another apocalypse of novel full of, you know, hatred and
the end of innocence.
And rage.
And the death of childhood.
The death of childhood. It's very, very bleak and sad.
And also a tale, obviously, of dominance and greed, of Rabbit, the fascist leader, Pooh, the greedy capitalist in search of honey. Piglet, I feel...
It must be destroyed.
Piglet's the ever-deluded proletariat.
OK. But isn't he like Squealer?
Anyway, this is another book.
I think we went off topic there. But I think the other thing, the reason that's interesting, is you have just taken me on a bit of a walk, Tim.
Yes, well...
We didn't manifest here. We arrived here.
Well, that's because he describes coming into London and coming up Baker Street. So we met at Baker Street. And then he does say he goes up Park Road along... alongside Regent's Park, and he sees, well, he first of all, he hears a strange noise.
Yes. Should we talk about the noise? Or do?
Well, we had a difference of opinion.
Well, it's written on the page, U-L-L-A, U-L-L-A, U-L-L-A.
Ulla, ulla, ulla.
Right. I thought it was ulla, ulla, ulla.
You think the Martians are quite high-pitched, don't you?
Well, I'll tell you what made me think about that. Adam Roberts, the science fiction author... He's a big H.G. Wells expert, far more expert than we are. And he wrote a whole blog. He reread the whole of Wells a few years ago and wrote a blog about it, Wells at the World's End, which is very good. Wells at the World's End. And he makes the point that the noise of the Martians sounds like a call to prayer from a minaret.
Ooh, that's quite good, isn't it?
Which I quite like for two reasons.
Yes.
Obviously, well, actually three reasons. So... Robert says it's actually an Imperial reference.
You know, okay.
It's another ring of the Martians.
Yes.
Which I think is quite interesting. The other thing is, obviously, Wells lived near a mosque.
In Woking.
When he was writing the book. We've discussed the mosque. And obviously now there's a massive mosque just where he might have seen the Martians.
Almost exactly there. Yeah.
Almost exactly in the same spot.
I thought it was going to be much lower than that. I thought it was going to be like a didgeridoo or something.
Yeah, I quite like that as well. Yeah, but that did sound like a didgeridoo.
We've come to the end of our journey. We
yes.
ought to rate this book. We should give it our what I like to call our Q-spec rating.
So we rating for artistic merit and then a rating for specificity. So artistic merit, I'm going to give this book an 8.
8?
I'm going to go quite high. I'm going to go for an 8. I think it's a great, great book, and more people
past,
should read it.
In the past, you've talked about this book as a 10, but then you'd have nowhere to go for all the other books
no,
that are
coming.
No,
well, my favourite book in the world is Portrait of a Lady, so that's my benchmark.
Okay.
That's a 10.
So 8 is good, then.
This is 20% less good than Portrait of a Lady.
That's what ratings are about.
That's what ratings are about.
Boiling it down to a stupid mark.
Yeah.
I'm going 7. 7
okay.
out of 10.
You're a bit firmer than me. Your Goodreads ratings are quite firm.
Well, it's very hard to get a 10 from me.
Yeah, I know. I've tried so hard. A rating for specificity. How curiously specific is this book about dates and locations, would you say? I'm going to let you go first on this one.
Well, I'm quite admiring of this because it's mapped out all the days. He doesn't get a weekday wrong. We've got dates. He's even got his Mars dates right. I mean, and his travelling is all viable. That you could travel between each location during those days. So it's hard not to give him a 10, actually, but I'm going to give him a 9.
Okay. I agree with all that. I think it's a great example of write what you know, okay? You know, because he was writing about places he lived or had lived had a real understanding about how places went backwards and forwards. I mean, the slightly odd excursion to Leatherhead and not back notwithstanding, which is just a bit narratively weird in the book. It's clearly right in terms of location. So I would agree with your nine. I
yeah,
also give it a nine.
Well done. Well done.
So I'm giving him a total score of 17.
17, and I'm giving him 16.
16.
So that's pretty good, isn't it?
Well done, Mr. Wells.
Well done, and particularly on keeping track of your timeline.
Yeah.
Because as we go forward with some of the other books, we're going to have some words with some of these writers about keeping control
of
their timeline.
Up? Are you measuring up?
Yeah. Do you know your Wednesday from your Thursday?
So that's Primrose Hill.
You know, of course, that Primrose Hill was owned by, or a large tract to it was owned by Eton College before it became a part.
Is there any part of England that isn't at least partly owned by Eton College?
No.
Well, there is an Eton College connection to this book.
That's why I've teed it up for you,
did
mate.
Tee it up very
I've
well. So in Claire Tomalin's excellent biography of The Young Wells, which has just been published, she talks about George Orwell and Cyril Connolly.
Cyril Connolly?
Cyril Connolly. Being at school together in the summer of 1914 and jointly reading The Country of the Blind, an H.G. Wells short story.
Oh, okay.
And they were both huge, huge Wells fans. Orwell wrote this about him, which I think is really good. Thinking people who were born about the beginning of this century are in some sense Wells's own creation. I doubt whether anyone who was writing books between 1900 and 1920, at any rate in the English language, influenced the young so much. The minds of all of us, and therefore the physical world, would be perceptibly different if Wells had never existed. And then he really gets going.
Mm.
There you were, in a world of pedants, clergymen and golfers, with your future employers exhorting you to get on or get out, your parents systematically warping your sexual life, and your dull-witted schoolmasters sniggering over their Latin tags. And here was this wonderful man who could tell you about the inhabitants of the planets and the bottom of the sea, and who knew that the future was not going to be what respectable people imagined. Up to 1914, Wells was in the main a true prophet.
Wow.
Good, isn't it?
Wow. Well, he's giving it a very high Q-spec rating.
I think he's probably going for a solid 10. That was War of the Worlds by H.G. Wells.
Quite an adventure.
Quite an adventure. We'd like to say some thank yous.
I know who you're going to thank.
I want to thank Ian Wakeford. Okay, so Ian Wakeford, a local historian in Woking, done tons of work on War of the Worlds and Wells, which you got a bit jealous at one point, I thought. That was a bit
Well, I'm presuming Ian is presenting the next podcast.
Well, unless it's on War of the Worlds, probably not. But Ian Wakeford's website is at wokinghistory.org. I strongly urge you to check it out. It's got a ton of really good stuff on it. If you live in Woking and you haven't looked at it, then you've really...
You're missing out.
You've really been missing out.
I want to say thank you to the artist Learning Music, who I found on Free Music Archive, which if you have never used, you should have a look at. It's basically a repository of lots of Creative Commons music, and it's from there that we got our lovely little loop of music that we use as our theme tune. So thank you, Learning Music. If you are interested in any of the other clips that we use in the show, music or otherwise, you need to subscribe to our Patreon page.
Yeah,
patreon.com.
We put all our show notes up there, including quite a lot of the additional research we do and links to all the, you know, excerpts, outtakes, video, audio. It's all there. So go to patreon.com and search for Curiosity Specific, and you'll see what the subscription tiers are. Thanks for listening. Give us a like or a subscribe on whatever podcast you're listening to this on.
Yes, that's important to us. Please do.
And maybe give us a follow. We're on Twitter as Curiosity Spec.
Yes.
We're on Instagram as Curiosity Specific.
We are.
And I believe we're on Facebook. Stig, who does our marketing, insisted that we go on Facebook. And,
he calls it Meta now.
He calls it Meta. But neither of us are particularly happy about it.
We have a YouTube channel as well.
We have
a podcast is available.
We have a YouTube channel as well, yeah.
Other platforms are available.
Other platforms are available, but Stig forces us to say that kind of stuff. So please like and subscribe, follow, and check out our Patreon page.